me welcome my guest, Nomfundo Kaluva. Good evening. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Michael. Good evening to you and to the Kaya FM listeners.
Oh, man, I've been, you know, it's sort of, I spent much of the day listening to you, on the internet, and what a wonderful pleasure it was to listen to. So I really enjoy your music, and you know, I would relish the opportunity to see you live.
Thank you very much. It will come. Trust me. We have to believe.
Indeed, we have to believe. Indeed. I also want to welcome. I'm not sure. So she's joining us from Lagos. So the line might be a little bit of a problem. But we'll give it a shot. Dr. Chijioke Akori from Lagos, who's currently in Lagos. Dr. Akori, good evening, and thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Michael.
Oh, what a relief.
I'm
the
excited.
Line is good.
Yeah.
What a relief. The line is very good. I'm very happy to be talking to you too. So you know, I don't know where to start because there's just so much ground to cover. But a good point is maybe to start with you, Nomfundo, and just talk about, you know, the times in which we live. I mean, you are an artist in a time that could potentially be very exciting, particularly if you think about the number of platforms that you are able to be heard on, but also maybe not. You know, what's your take, and what's the sense from a jazz artist point of view?
Well, I mean, it's a tricky one, right? Because you know, it's there's pros and cons. There's, you know, and I suppose artists, you know, who've lived in all kinds of different times, you know, faced you know, a similar thing where, you know, every circumstance and every environment in time presents opportunities and it presents challenges. Mm. But I think right now, you know, for me as a jazz artist, it's difficult. It's difficult, and I think I speak on behalf of a lot of my colleagues in the industry, because if anything, this pandemic, this time we're living in, and this sort of global catastrophe of COVID-19 has highlighted some bitter pills, mm-hmm. about where artists really fall within the realm of the economy.
Yeah.
And within the spectrum of what is important value-wise. And I think about, okay, we can sit and go, well, the platforms are absolutely multi-sided. There's so many of them. But then we need to start asking ourselves, especially right now, whether do we have the capacity to monetize? You know, ultimately, are we making money from the various platforms that we have and the digital space, right? And it's so great to have Chijioke, Dr. Okori online, because, you know, she's a specialist in this copyright space and the internet, you know, and we're putting concerts and content online because we're desperately wanting to share our craft. But then again, I kind of find myself, like last night, I found myself thinking, as a jazz musician, this music thrives in the presence of an audience.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it thrives in the presence of a live audience because it's premised on a synergy, you know. So I'm grappling, and it will be quite interesting to hear what other jazz musicians are feeling. But for me, that's where my mind is at right now.
And I guess, you know, so when we talk about COVID-19 from an economics point of view, we say, you know, hang on, you know, we went into COVID-19 with a bleeding economy. We were just for the term on recession. And, you know, of course, COVID-19 is going to make things worse. And that's from an economy point of view. But I think the story is no different specific to music. I think the cries of musicians pre-existed COVID-19, and I just want to maybe get the appreciation of what is the difference. I mean, you know, you already, where were you before COVID-19, and how is that exacerbated?
So you make such a valid point, and I've been saying this, you know, I've been saying that, you know, for a lot of musicians who have been gigging regularly, you know, high-end earners in the music business, you know, this is a bit of a shock to their system. But the larger majority of musicians who are not in mainstream, this is their reality.
Wow.
Because they don't have the space, right? They're not getting the bookings to perform. So for me personally, pre-COVID-19, I mean, I lecture, right? I lecture music at the University of Cape Town, and I'm studying. I'm 6 months shy now, finishing my MBA. So, and then I serve on the board of the Samuel Foundation and all that, you know. So I've been able to kind of craft a career for myself where I earn income from more than one thing.
Right.
And I decided to do this about sort of late 2016 because I realized that, you know, I'm not going to sustain myself just from singing. And it was a very difficult reality.
So when you went and you started an MBA course, you were not thinking about it in terms of enhancing your music monetization. You were thinking about it as an alternative income. Do I understand that? Because my next question would have been, with an MBA, you know, how do you then foresee the future? You know, how does the business studies assist in the craft of art?
Well, actually, when I started the MBA, I didn't really know why I was doing it. When they told me, I was like, it's only like sort of a year and a half in, and I realized, oh, this is why I'm doing this. You know, because you know, I mean, and as you get older and as you experience more in the music business, in the music world, you realize. So for me, the MBA, if anything, has highlighted this disparity between music and the music business.
Yeah.
That they are two completely separate things. And I didn't know that coming into music, because I thought that if I can sing jazz and I can sing well and record albums, then I know the business. I'm in the music business. Mm. But then, you know, you realize when you churn out the albums and you're performing and stuff, and then at the end of the month you looked at your bank account and you go, really? You know, and it's just really good business. And so the MBA is great because I've been able to then really delve deeper into the business, right? Because the modules give you the scope to be able to research stuff that's related to your line of work.
Yeah.
So that's really great, because now I can take all of that and I can actually apply it into my own career. So already I'm thinking, okay, I want to record album number 3, but I need to have a conversation with my label.
Right.
Because now I know a couple of things I didn't know before, right? So I think that's the thing for me. And so for me, COVID-19 in this period, I'm taking it as an opportunity to obviously finish studying and stuff like that. And I'm teaching remotely for the University of Cape Town.
I want to talk a little bit about that as well, about some of the teaching and how that has changed. But I think you've sort of mentioned something that I find particularly interesting. And because when we talk about the plight of musicians and artists in general, you know, I think sometimes it's very difficult to pin down the problem and say, where is the problem? You mentioned in passing the you know, the negotiation with your label, but somebody else might say, well, hang on, is it maybe that as a people with the economy and the fast-paced life that we're living in, that the people themselves are no longer interested in outdoor events and no longer have an appreciation for the arts? Or is it, you know, so is one, the labels, two, us, the consumers of your music, or three, technology? You know, when we talk about, you know, technology and the multi-sided platforms that are out there, if we were to pin, or can't we even pin it, if we were to pin the problem to say this is where it is to be located? Because you'd remember many years ago when we were talking about Mahlathini, the discussion was, oh, the label ripped him off, or, you know, he negotiated badly, or this and that. But I'm wondering, whether is that still the problem, or have we now got new problems?
I think it's a hybrid of the three things that you mentioned, right? So for me, if I had to whittle it down to maybe two words, I would say, well, okay, maybe not two. So, okay, two, transparency.
All right.
Lack of transparency in the music business, right? Mm-hmm. And so transparency in the sense that the people who really handle the money from the different platforms are not really very transparent in terms of how that money moves, right? Mm-hmm. So it's transparency, or the lack thereof. And then secondly, it's knowledge, information, education, you know, falling under one word of knowledge. So as artists, I think we need to know more. We need to study more. Right. And when I say study, I'm not saying we must all enroll for a bachelor of what,
yes.
But we need to understand, learn, and inform ourselves and empower ourselves, which is why I'm saying now, I'm going to now have to have a conversation with my label, right? Because I'm more knowledgeable about.
Would that sort of be the silver bullet then? you know, a conversation with the label, would that be the silver bullet, or would there be residual issues of Michael is listening to my music at home and he doesn't come out to the concert and I'm not fully booked?
Yeah, there will be residual, because you see, the consumer behavior is different now in the world of digital platforms.
Yeah.
Right? Because now people consume music a lot, mm-hmm. right? Not that they didn't before, but they consume it more easily and more accessible on their devices.
Yeah.
Right. So so there's that. And me as an artist, I earn less money per stream, mm-hmm. right? As opposed to maybe when people only had the option of buying the full CD.
Right.
Now consumers can just like one or two songs from your album and they'll just stream it as and when they want.
Right.
Right. So the label also is going to have to fight for their end of the bargain. So mm-hmm. that's why I'm saying it's so important to be able to come into this information, to research it, to understand it, so that the conversation between the artist and the label, if you have a label, is deeper, right? It's deeper, and it's these like really important questions that you can actually engage in. But those who run the industry, you know, the label executives, and they're not going to offer this information up, Michael. That's the fact of the matter.
Mm.
You see, they're not going to say, well, you know, let's get together. I want to teach you about how this works, and I want to show you what, you know, how much money, you know, your album generated from this and how much. No, they're not. They're just going to pay it to Samro, and then Samro will just pay you as the artist, and you're going to see this money appear in your bank account, and you're going to take it and you know, and move on.
Yeah.
You know, but no one's really prodding and kind of going, give me a breakdown of what's going on there. What's the money trail here?
You know?
So, yeah.
I want to take a break, but before I do so, I just want to touch on something, just so that, you know, when we talk about multi-sided music platforms, if I can just, you know, of course, there'll be a lot more to talk about after the break, but Dr. Okore, if I can just sort of, just give me a short introduction of what we're talking about when we talk about multi-sided music platforms, because, you know, I'm the guy from the cassettes and the LPs.
So multi-sided music platforms, so the term multi-sided is a term coined by economists, you know, to explain a specific kind of business model that started to become popular with the emergence of the internet, you know, and digitalization. So you have a platform that earns money from dealing with different sides of the market. So take a piece of music, for instance. You have a digital platform, so it's online, mm-hmm. and it's dealing with, on one side, musicians. You know, dealing with musicians on one side, mm-hmm. dealing with us, the public, who listen to music on one side, mm-hmm. and then dealing with advertisers on the other side.
Mm.
So you have, you know, someone who puts music on this digital platform. You have people who come to listen to music on that platform. And then you have advertisers who say, oh, here are musicians on this platform, and here are, you know, listeners on this platform. I can put my product or advertise my product or service on this platform, and this, you know, number of people get to see this thing. So the platform itself then makes money from the advertisers, from the very fact that someone has placed music on that platform for a lot of people to come on the platform to listen.
Mm-hmm. I want to take a break, and when we continue, we're going to be exploring with my guest the issue of, you know, when you're talking about regulatory framework in the context of multi-sided music platforms, what are you actually talking about? Because, you know, it's not something that I can readily put my finger on and say I understand. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we continue our chat.
The Law Report with Michael Motsoeneng Bell, Kaya FM 95.9.
Welcome back. If you've just joined us, I'm in conversation with Nomfundo Kaluva. She's a vocalist and pianist, and also occupies a few other seats. She's a deputy chairperson of Samro Foundation, as well as a member of the Jazz Day South Africa, and also Dr. Chijioke Akori. She's the author of the Multi-Sided Music Platforms and the Law Book. And I think we're going to be sort of trying to understand and dissect a lot of what she writes in the book, because this is something that is new to many of us. When we were talking about copyrights before, it was literally in a very narrow sense of some of the obvious things, but things are moving rapidly, they're moving quickly, but also they're moving at a global scale. So I'm just kind of trying to imagine, a song, a South African song playing in Lagos, and what law governs it there relative to here. But that's not even the problem. The problem is something I want to get to, which is the people that own a lot of these platforms are not even on this continent, but the music is from this continent, and also the consumers are from this continent to a large extent. And that's something that I guess is somewhat heartbreaking, because it extends well beyond music. But let's talk about, when we talk about a regulatory framework, are we even able to talk about a regulatory framework in the context of multi-sided music platforms globally? I guess that was for you, Dr. Akori.
That's for me. I hear you when you say it's heartbreaking, and the fact that these platforms are in various parts of the world. So in terms of regulatory framework, we have to, put at the forefront of our mind the fact that the music in question is protected by copyright law.
Yeah.
And it's copyright law that determines how you're supposed to engage with a copyright-protected work.
Yes.
And so under the Copyright Act in South Africa, in wherever you have a copyright statute in place, there are different categories of work that are protected. And so you have a track, for instance, and in that track, there are different kinds of protected works in that single track. So you have the lyrics of the song protected as a literary work under our copyright law. Yes. And then you have the musical composition itself, the beat, the instrumental, what makes the song, protected as a musical work. And then you have the recording of the song protected as a sound recording. And then if you have a music video, it's protected as a cinematograph film. And then you have maybe the album artwork or the single artwork and, the photograph of the artist that you use to market and all of those things that will be protected as an artistic work. So there's a lot of copyright protected work in a single piece of music that we hear. And now you have these multi-sided platforms, which I've explained that they are essentially a place where different sides of the market gather. So if you are an artist or a record label, what you're looking to do is to put your music where the public can access it. Of course, you have, like Nomfundo said, you have different, streams of income from being a performer or a songwriter or a singer. So you have, monies coming in from live performances, and you have monies coming in when your music is played on radio or on TV. You have money coming in when your music is used in films and all of those things, right? So essentially, under copyright law, you already have the rights to lead you to get revenue, because the copyright laws would say, would already, make provisions and say that if you're the copyright owner or the author of this piece of music, you are entitled to a bundle of exclusive rights. The right to reproduce the work, it's essentially you that get to do that, mm-hmm. Exclusively. The right to distribute the work, the right to perform the work, and, a whole lot of different kinds of rights that you have.
Mm.
So if you hold on to the music yourself, of course, nobody's going to buy it and you're not going to make any money. So you need to have the music out there so that you get to make money.
Mm-hmm.
And if you retain the rights by yourself to say, I have this exclusive bundle of rights given to me under the law, I'm going to, stay on top of it. I'm going to be the only one dealing with this music, deciding what happens and all of those things. You make money, but your money is limited. So you need to license the work to different people,
mm-hmm.
and then they pay you a licensing fee, and then you make money and things like that. In an ideal world, that's how it should be, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then before the internet, things were essentially linear, because you can produce 500 CDs. And when you've sold 500 CDs, you know that you've sold 500 CDs.
Yeah.
But what do you have in the internet space? You have the rate of reproduction happening, you know, in nanoseconds. So I can be here listening to Nomfundo's song on YouTube in Nigeria, and you can be in South Africa listening to the same music on YouTube, or maybe on Spotify, or maybe on SoundCloud. You know, so there are different platforms where people can access the same piece of music. And then the question is, between where you find the songs and the copyright owners of those songs, how does the money flow? Who gets, you know, who gets money?
Yeah.
And then you have these multi-sided platforms who don't, their business is not to create copyright protected works. So they are not like a record label that is in the business of making records, right? Mm-hmm. They are not in the business of singing. They are not in the business of setting up, of booking shows and, you know, selling tickets and all of those things. Their own is to just, you know, have the platform and then make it free of charge for people to come onto the platform and upload music. So if you're an upcoming artist, for instance, and you don't maybe have a label, or you're an artist owned record label and you're just starting out, right? Mm-hmm. A platform like YouTube, for instance, is fantastic. You know, depending on how you look at it, but it's fantastic for you because you don't need to pay a dime to put your music, to upload your song on YouTube.
Yes.
And then if you and I, Michael, if we want to listen to Nomfundo's songs, for instance, we don't need to pay a dime to come on YouTube or any of this, or on Facebook or on SoundCloud or wherever the music is on the platform. We usually would not need to pay any money, mm-hmm. any money to anybody to listen to those things. Now, the challenge then becomes, this music is protected by copyright law. Just imagine for a second that it's not the copyright owner who uploads the song on YouTube. So say I have Nomfundo's song somewhere and I upload it to YouTube. I don't talk to Nomfundo. Nomfundo doesn't know me either, and I don't know her. Mm-hmm. But I know her music and I upload it on YouTube, right?
Yes.
And everybody gets to listen to the song because it's on YouTube. And YouTube makes money because that song is there. Because, so say she has like 10 million views in 1 week, for instance. There's, you know, a lot of companies who would want their products advertised when, you know, the song is being streamed. So, you know, before you get to listen to a song on YouTube, you usually see, you know, an ad being played. Mm-hmm. So that's how money is made on those platforms, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the problem now is when you have that kind of scenario where, you know, this platform is not responsible for uploading the song on the platform, but it benefits from the fact that the song is there and people are listening to it. How do you apply copyright law to address that kind of use? Because bear in mind that the artist in question can't spend her own, you know, her whole time or his own time chasing each and every, you know, those 10 million views, chasing, you know, them all over the world to say, who put my song there?
Yeah.
You streamed it. It's reproduction. I have exclusive rights. You must pay me something.
But let me invite you to distinguish between two scenarios and exactly the same sort of example that you've provided. Two scenarios where I've put up deliberately my music onto YouTube to make it available, and this was some sort of a, you know, I intended it to be that way. And another scenario where I haven't put it up. I've sold a disc, and I stood at the back of my boot and I sold, but somebody then uploads it not on my behalf. So meaning that I don't have an arrangement with YouTube or with whatever platform. Of those two scenarios, which one are you explaining now? Which one are you dealing with now? Because it would be interesting to draw that distinction for the listeners.
So if you're the copyright owner and you deliberately decide that YouTube is a platform SoundCloud yeah. or, you know, whatever platform is where you want to put your music, because, you know, that's where you want to put your music, then yeah. it wouldn't be an infringement. And so you wouldn't really be complaining that someone is ripping you off, in terms of infringing on your copyrights.
Yes.
Right? Uh-huh. I'll still come to this example.
But then in that example,
let's go to the other side.
Yeah.
Sorry?
In that example where you've put it up, do mm-hmm. you, is there some mm-hmm. kind of a mechanism for you to get paid if it does hit 10 million views?
Yeah, so YouTube has what it calls AdSense, where you have like a relationship with YouTube itself or with content management, content aggregators or content management system owners. So mm-hmm. there's YouTube partners, I think that's what it's called.
Yeah.
So those people have a contract with YouTube where they share revenue that they get from ad streams. Mm-hmm. You ad revenues, they share it with YouTube. So a label like Universal, for instance, or like Sony Music, those are the big record labels, you know, globally. They have an arrangement with YouTube. They have a contract with YouTube, you know, where mm-hmm. when they have they upload, you know, their artist's song on their YouTube channel, mm-hmm. the ad revenue that is made from those uploads, they get to share it with YouTube.
Okay.
Or YouTube gets to share it with them.
Okay.
So, but even in that scenario, you know, there's still some agitations from artists that, you know, the revenue is nothing to write home about. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's in which is, you know, part of what I talk about.
But I mean,
in my book.
And
so
I guess if we use an Umfundo Ekpaluva as an example, I've just gone on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing mm-hmm. that appears on YouTube is something that looks like her own content that she's put up. It's an album, and I think there I'm sure there's an arrangement, but I'm open for you to educate me. But then there's a footage on a show called Espresso Show. You know, so there's uh-huh. sort of different platforms or different, not uh-huh. platforms, it might all just be YouTube, but different mediums or different people that have put it up.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I guess, and there's also one from Kaya TV, that's us.
Well, look, I don't know if this is a good thing to say. Let me come in here now, Michael.
Sure.
I'm slightly embarrassed to say this, but you know, in the spirit of transparency, you know, I've got to live by my word.
Yeah.
I have never, I Nomfundo Kaluva, have never physically uploaded any content onto YouTube.
Yeah.
So basically, anything, any video, anything of me that you see on YouTube has been uploaded by somebody else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the worry. So my question is, and I guess you're welcome to answer it. Who gets, you know, do you get paid for this? I mean, I see one with your album cover, so it could be your label. But I'm just going to check if I can, you know, listen to it freely. There you go. I managed to get to it for free. Yeah.
Yeah. So as Dr. Okori was saying, you know, because the sound recording of the album is protected under that copyright, like right on the sound recording copyright. Mm-hmm. So Universal will collect the revenue generated, whatever revenue. I mean, you know, the whole R5, right? you know, collected from YouTube, and will act as the aggregator between myself and the platform. Mm-hmm. But I cannot even begin to tell you how many independent artists. And because remember, YouTube is a user content generated platform, yeah. right? So it's the users who upload the content on it. So, and there's so many independent artists who put their stuff onto YouTube, because to them, you know, the trade-off is that they get...
I get known.
That's the thing, right? Mm. And it's exactly, it goes back to what I was saying at the beginning of our interview, where I said, you know, it's great because we put ourselves on these platforms, but at what point are we going to start seeing money, revenue come out from these, you know, from these platforms? And Dr. Okori spoke, and I think, you know, what she's saying is that what we're not quite getting to is how does the money flow,
right? Because you get these aggregators, right, who will then, obviously, who are in between. And then you get publishers who also have to get their fair share of it. And so the artist, you know, how is that money moving? You know, and when are we going to actually see the data and to be able to track? Because I sit and I think to myself, well, in an age of such modern technology, why isn't there a tracking system where I, as a musician, can actually go and track? And I think in other parts of the world, or maybe other places or whatever, or, you know, maybe other people have access to that kind of technology, I can actually track, you know? So I'm part of SAMRO, which is, you know, the collection management organization that pays royalties, you know, to musicians and to artists and composers. You know, and I still think to myself, well, surely there should be a technology where I can see that my song was played on Kaya on this day, and then it was played on that place and there, and when it was played there, that's how much it was. It was streamed there, and that's how much money I made from the streams, and actually be able to track it, so then I can then arrive at the amount that I see in my bank account. But we're not there, and I'm not sure why. What is the bottleneck between, you know, kind of being able to trace that, to trace, and maybe it's because the digital space is not adequately regulated. I mean, you know, you were saying earlier on that, you know, all the Spotify's and all these, like, Apple, you know, none of them are South African, or, you know, even African, really.
Yeah.
You know, none of them, you know, so we have to work, we have to fit into their model.
You know, when you're having a good show, you know, when a good broadcaster calls your show, George Manyosi.
Hey, Mike, how's it?
Good, man. How are you?
Yeah, super fascinating.
No, man, you check your computer. Hey, you're funny like a celebrity.
Yeah. Yeah, no, this subject is close to all our hearts.
All right, hit me, brother. What's up?
Okay, two things. One for maybe another day. Even governments are struggling with taxing revenues on digital spaces like the YouTubes and all that. You check Davos, I mean, that was a bone of contention. Major debates are going on about that, where U.S. companies are just, you know, making a killing, financially speaking. And governments are having a problem in other countries where they can't really, you know, geographically place the revenue and this and that. So that's another subject for another, you know, day, but something very fascinating there that you can look at. For today, for this subject, you know, you guys talk about YouTube. I mean, you will notice, especially with a lot of these account holders with YouTube who will go and upload someone's original creation or whatever without even your knowledge, as you highlighted earlier, then they would get away with these things and make money from YouTube by just going and stating that disclosure at the bottom there, disclaimer, you know, that this content is for educational purposes or for news purposes only sharing, and this is fair use. They use the fair use law of 1976, which is pretty much accepted by YouTube and the likes. And as I said, account holders then you know, get paid through advertising streams and all that kind of stuff without any cent going to the originator or creator of that content. That's one of those big things.
You know, you raise so many issues, and even the tax one, it actually isn't remote from today's show, because I mean the tax issue is a broader one. I mean, you can imagine out of all the technology that gets flown into Africa, how much of the tax gets collected here. In fact, some of their own countries don't even collect the money. These companies are registered in Netherlands and in Ireland, etc. So that's a seriously big issue. But is it that easy to just get away with, you know, copyright? We're just putting up a disclaimer on YouTube, Dr. Okwara. Is it as easily as George says?
So that's the challenge, right, Michael and George? That's the challenge. So even in the EU, even in the European Union, there's you know, and even in the US, there's always been that conversation about who do you hold responsible for what is going on these platforms. And it's not just YouTube. There's SoundCloud. There's, you know, even in Nigeria, there's platforms like Not Just OK, Too Exclusive, you know, different platforms that, you know, have you know, tons and tons of content that people upload themselves. You know, sometimes it's the artist uploading, sometimes it's other people uploading and all of those things. So the challenge has always been, who do you hold responsible? So under various, you know, copyright laws or related laws, like in South Africa, the Electronic Communication and Transaction Act, you know, has a safe harbor provision that says if you're merely hosting content, if all you do is just to be there and people, you know, come to your platform and put, you know, their content for you to host, so you're just there providing this nice hosting service, that you are exempted, you know, from being liable for copyright infringement if, when you're contacted by the actual copyright owner, you take down the content. So YouTube will just say to you, or a Not Just Okay, for instance, will say to you, or a SoundCloud will say to you, as soon as Nomfundo says to us that this, you know, this my song, this my track that you have on your platform was not authorized by me or by my record label to be here, as soon as Nomfundo says that, we are going to take it down. So they just
it still doesn't put money in your pocket, though. Sorry.
That's the challenge.
We apologize that we're just going to put it down to tomorrow. But you know, for 3 months that you didn't even know that it was there, they were collecting the Benjamins.
Yeah, but exactly. Also, but think about it this way, you know, because everybody's got to take responsibility, right? And artists themselves as well. So we all have to take responsibility, and we all need to sit upright and look at these things and find and look and find stuff. So oftentimes when people say, oh, I saw a video of you on YouTube doing this and that, and you maybe didn't know that someone, you know, uploaded. I mean, and I know this from, you know, being a performer. So I know that when I'm on stage, everybody is out filming with their smartphone, right? There's just nothing you can do about it.
Oh, there's something that you can tell people. I've been to a few where they're like, put your phone down.
Man, you don't, you know, like, that's so nice. Yeah, no, then you're being a wet blanket. It's like, don't fool me. And it's like, are you mad? Of course you're going to fool me. So it's okay because people want to take a piece of the performance home with them. That's the world we live in. People film everything, right? So, and then the next thing you find that your video's on YouTube, blah, 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 blah. But now when you find out, you see, you are, we are often happy to have our content online because there are so few avenues where we are able to share our craft, because you're not going to find us on television. And also, we're no longer living in the age of music videos. Remember, there was a time in the 90s where in between, you know, shows and in between, see, there were music videos.
Yes.
Now, we're not there anymore. So the pool, you know, where we can actually be able to showcase ourselves and be seen is so small that we are now not asking beyond. We're not penetrating that question of going, oh, really? Is that video on YouTube? Oh, that's great. What we should then follow up with is, what does that mean? That's what we need. So we as artists need to be able to ask the question after the question. You see, we stop too soon because we're basking in just the fact that it's up there for other people to see. And it's great because clients will say to you, Nomfundo, we'd like to book you for this event, blah, 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 because, you know, this is a new partnership or whatever. Do you have any material online, any videos online that the client can see? And if you don't have stuff on, you know, on YouTube or whatever, you know, you're unlikely to get the gig.
But, I mean, you could have it on a paid platform like Apple Music, Spotify, Deezer, or whatever. That could suffice as well.
You could,
yeah.
Right?
But remember, yeah. But let's do this. Let's do this. Let's do this. Nomfundo, let me just play one of your tracks. You know, because I'm not unlike George Manyosi, they get to play music. I get to do a lot of talking. And COVID-19, thank you. I get to play more than one song. I'm going to play this one. 10 minutes before 9 o'clock, we continue our conversation. I'm in conversation with a vocalist that you've just listened to right now doing a cover, Nomfundo Qaluva, as well as Dr. Chijioke Agori. And we're talking about, you know, the new age in which we live, but also an interesting book that Dr. Agori has written, which is the multi-sided music platforms and it's specific to music, because you can imagine there's a lot of things that are going to be happening. But one of the things that, you know, as sort of the part of the review to your book, Dr. Agori, that was spoken of is an introduction of an African perspective into the issues pertaining to copyrights. Explain and take us through that.
Okay, so in terms of talking about multi-sided music platforms and the relationship between that and copyright law and competition law and privacy law, you know, those are the legal the regulatory frameworks that I dealt with in the book. There's a lot of conversation, you know, on those aspects outside Africa.
Yeah.
You know, outside the global south, outside the emerging developing economies. So last year, the European Union, you know, went through the process of a digital single market directive and, you know, dealing with value gap proposal. Essentially, artists, you know, record labels, collecting societies in those climes, we are saying that the monies that they are getting from user-generated content platforms, you know, I don't want to keep mentioning YouTube because there are, you know, tons of other platforms that do the same thing. It's just that YouTube is, you know, like a very visible example because most people, you know, have access to it and know about it. But those conversations have been going on in those places, essentially saying that, you know, who do we hold responsible for these things that happen? You know, George called and mentioned that, you know, you have people who upload someone else's content and says, just putting this for educational use, this is fair use, and all of those things. But within our copyright laws, those things don't, you know, those things don't make sense in the context of our laws, because it's either you are infringing or you are not infringing. But at the end of the day, like you said, Michael, who gets the money? Mm. You know, where is the money coming from and who gets the money? Mm. And that's the problem that copyright law has been grappling with, you know, over time. In terms of the African, you know, Africa-focused conversation, you know, I of course, part of the things that you have to, part of the things that I considered was there's, you know, this conversation going on in the US, there's this conversation going on in the EU. But what of, you know, our own perspective, our own context, you know, as Africans? Because if you say, oh, why don't the artists access other platforms like Spotify, which is a subscription-based platform, or maybe access platforms like Deezer, which is, you know, subscription-based and all of those things. But we do need to ask ourselves, how many of our people can afford to, you know, pay a subscription on Spotify?
Yeah.
How many of our people can afford to pay a subscription on Apple Music?
Yes, because, you know, it's not only the question of subscription, it's also
because
that's
our reality.
Indeed. Sorry? But it's also a question of, you know, once you've subscribed, now you got to stream and now you need the data.
Exactly. So that's our context. So in formulating our own laws, because South Africa, you know, started the copyright amendments, you know, process since 2015.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a country, South Africa is still at it, even as we speak, you know. And the process has always been to hear from the artists, to hear from the copyright owners, to hear from the independent record labels, to hear from the public, to hear from users of music content. What are their realities? How do you reform the laws to make sense for the African context? Because you can't just import these laws because they sound nice, or import these laws from, you know, wherever, without considering our own, you know, national context, our own experience and realities.
Are we not doomed though? Are we not doomed in terms of music as we are with pretty much everything else? Because if you take the example of China, for example, they don't have Google, or at least Google is available on a very limited basis because of this very thing that they understood. And that's why companies like Tencent are doing so well, because they use Chinese search engines and Chinese this, even if it means that some of these other search engines have got to be blocked or frustrated. Is it that we are doomed in two ways? One, we will never be united. Nigeria and South Africa can't agree on a lot of things, and I don't know what's the beef between the two governments, but there certainly does. But that's just one example. But besides the beef, we just simply can't speak as an African voice. We always speak with a Nigerian voice and a South African voice. That's the first thing. But even if you tried, I mean, we tried a little move with chickens, where we were saying, oh, if you want, we can't have cheap chickens coming into South Africa. And we were given a few threats of what would get cut from us if we don't take the drumsticks from these other countries. And it's exactly the same with music. The minute you want to say, hang on, Google has an unfair advantage over us, because guess what? Google's laws are not, they don't consider South African law, Nigerian law, or even law in Sudan. They consider their American and Western laws, and we're just going to have to work around it and live with it pretty much. And you, as somebody who studied this, and me, who's somebody who is perhaps defeated in thinking, do you see any hope of us moving in any way where Africa can in some way fight back and have its own platforms for Africans, even if it is aided by government?
Yeah, absolutely. You know that there's the African Union came up with the African Continental Free Trade Agreement, and there are, you know, different protocols under the agreement. The protocol on intellectual property is supposed to be, there's supposed to be negotiations, for the protocol on intellectual property, and these are some of the issues, that the protocol is supposed to address. And we're all just waiting for the COVID-19 pandemic situation to ease, and so that we can get a sense of where we are in terms of that treaty. But that treaty is such a huge unifying force from a lot of perspectives, because it's supposed to address, the future that we want as Africans. So there's hope from that perspective.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I'm really glad. I'm afraid I have to end it here. There's so much. I wanted to talk about so much. Nomfundo also wanted to talk about, teaching and during these times, and we never got around to talking some of the work that you do on teaching. But thank you so much to both of you ladies for talking to me this evening.
Thank you, Michael.
And thank you so much to the Afropolitan. I hope that you've been enlightened as much as I have. It's been exceptionally informative to me, and I hope it's been the same for you. From me, Michael Motswenning Bill, until next Wednesday, good evening.